The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. This morning, the Chief Justice has been unavoidably detained. Nevertheless, we will begin. State of Ohio versus Lloyd. On behalf of the appellant, Noel Powell. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Associate Justices of the Ohio Supreme Court. May it please the Court, I'm Noel Powell on behalf of the appellant, Cronnie Lloyd. May I reserve 5 minutes' time for rebuttal, please? Cronnie Lloyd will potentially spend the rest of his life in prison for what is commonly called sometimes a one-punch murder. His guilt or innocence, or even his appropriate level of criminal liability, is not before this court. Really, whether or not his counsel was in fact ineffective is not before this court. Rather, in this moment before this court is whether or not the 8th District's decision was insufficient in its analysis of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. In particular, the record showed that Lloyd's counsel proceeded to trial not understanding the elements of the crime that Lloyd was charged with. And so counsel tried the case under a theory that had a 0% chance of success. We know this because the record shows that counsel stated that misunderstanding repeatedly on the record. When Lloyd raised this issue with the 8th District Court of Appeals, it failed to consider the attorney's actions in light of the fact that counsel did not understand the law. So the court, the 8th District, found that the presumption of competence was not rebutted. Using it like a rubber stamp failed to give Lloyd a meaningful review of his ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Briefly, Lloyd was on trial for felony murder when a single punch, wholly improbably and tragically, ended the life of Gary Power. The state did not have to prove an intent to kill, but the record shows that Lloyd's counsel attempted to convince the jury that Lloyd did not have an intent to kill and used that as a defense, which it certainly was not.
Counsel, are there any instances that you know of where defense counsel might use a strategy to maybe try to confuse the jury?
Your Honor, I cannot speak to whether or not that is something that happens on a regular basis. In this case, it would not be reasonable to argue incorrect law to the jury. I would also mention that in this case, counsel waived the opening argument, saying that she would give her opening argument following the state's evidence, did not do that as well. So the only time she argued directly to the jury, she argued an incorrect statement of the law.
Did the trial court give a correct statement of the law before deliberations?
Yes, Your Honor, the trial court did, which I think from the minds of the jury makes it all the more of a problem in the sense that on the one hand, the jury just heard from defense counsel that Lloyd did not have an intent to kill. Then the instructions would be given, and the jury would find out that that was useless information. It couldn't do anything to help their deliberations.
Counsel, was the subject of a lesser-included offense ever addressed with the trial court judge outside the presence of the jury?
No, Your Honor.
Not one reference to
it? Not that I'm aware of, no.
Didn't the 8th District find that there was no plain error on the lesser included offense issue?
Your Honor, that's correct.
And that's not on appeal here.
That's not on appeal here.
So even if we agree with you, we've got nothing to do, right?
Your Honor, what I'm asking this court is to adopt a simple finding that when the record shows that counsel persistently misunderstood the law, that rebuts the presumption. I'm not necessarily asking the court to reach the prejudice question. Before the 8th District,
Let me go back to my question. If the lesser included offense issue is not in front of us, and the 8th District so found there's no plain error, do we even have to rule in this case?
Yes, Your
Why?
Honor. I would say because the 8th District did not address the circumstances of the attorney not understanding the law. And to Your Honor's point, I believe that the 8th District was incorrect in saying that these instructions were not appropriate. However, to the extent that this court doesn't find that the record supports those, it is an extension of the court, of the trial counsel failing to understand what was at issue here. And again, I think that whether or not those instructions were appropriate goes to the prejudice prong. And what the 8th District has left behind here is a decision with some conclusory statements, some of which I would argue are not actually correct about how counsel was arguing this case, and simply said that that didn't rebut the presumption. Because what they did is they took the action of counsel in a vacuum and said, well, all or nothing trial strategies are perfectly fine. And certainly, what is a strategy in one circumstance is a mistake in the other, and that depends on the circumstances. And if we go back as far as to Strickland, and many cases since, have contemplated the fact that in looking at an attorney's action in the first prong on deficient performance is dependent on the circumstances. And here, Lloyd argued to the 8th, it's in the briefs and it's in the transcripts, that there is evidence that these decisions were not grounded in the law.
So you're saying, so you would want us to send this case back to the 8th District to determine whether there was deficient performance, or to say, send it back to the 8th and say there was deficient performance, now do the prejudice prong?
Yes, Your Honor.
The latter.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm asking for.
But do we know that the attorney really misunderstood the law? I mean, his argument was that he didn't, I get your point. I mean, I see what you're saying, but you could also look at this as he's saying he didn't intend to cause physical harm. Here the physical harm was the death, so that was the example he was using in this case. I mean, if the physical harm had been that, you know, he broke his nose, you could see him saying he didn't intend to, you know, one punch wouldn't break his nose, right? I mean, so I'm not sure the record completely bears out what you're saying, so help me with that.
Sure. Your Honor, I appreciate that point. And it, you know, we are in somewhat of an interesting position in that so often when we want to say that an attorney hasn't done everything he or she was supposed to do, we're in post-conviction territory looking outside of the record. But in this case, the only time counsel argued to the jury directly, she misstated the law. And I would say that if that was her point, that these consequences, i.e. death, she doesn't say that. She doesn't explain it. And it's going to fall flat in light of the instructions that they were going to be given by the judge.
Well, but if the attorney misunderstood the law, but the judge explained the law, so the jury understood the law, where's the prejudice there?
Well, again, I am not necessarily asking this court to reach prejudice, but I think when we look to some of the U.S. Supreme Court precedent around this, like Hinton and Wiggins, if a person in Cronnie Lloyd's position raises this issue with the court and is able to demonstrate these facts, I'm merely saying it should no longer enjoy the presumption of competence so that we can reach the next prong of this discussion.
Counsel, under Ohio law, judges don't have to tolerate all or nothing defenses if they see the evidence supports a lesser or could support a lesser included. Since State v. Wine, they have the right to instruct no matter if there's a request from the state or the defense. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
That didn't happen here.
That did not happen here. No, that's true. I see that my time is winding down. Ultimately, what happens to Lloyd in this case will be driven by the prejudice prong. Ultimately, I also think it is somewhat worth sparing a thought for this experience from Lloyd's point of view. The public has a working knowledge of many crimes, why theft is a crime. What most average member of the public does not understand is that you can throw one punch and end up as a murderer. So as he sat in this trial, he is dependent on his attorney's expertise, her professionalism, her research, all of those things. And frankly, I cannot think of anything more problematic than walking your client into a conviction that has a life tail, by the way, because you hadn't done your homework. Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Okay. Ms. Mullen.
Good morning, Your Honors. Excuse me. Catherine Mullen on behalf of the State of Ohio, Appley. We are respectfully requesting that this court either dismiss the instant appeal as improvidently allowed or alternatively affirm the decision of the 8th District Court of Appeals in this case. Your Honors, excuse me. I believe, as you just heard from my friend on the other side, the facts of this case are not largely in dispute. The law in this case is not largely in dispute.
It was according to defense counsel.
Well, and I'm happy that you raised that, Your Honor. I think, you know, and this goes to a point that Justice DeWine was talking about. We're talking about an extraordinarily experienced defense counsel in this case, one who, in fact, has been practicing since I was in elementary school.
Does the record bear that out?
That she's experienced?
I didn't ask that. Someone asked
over here. Does the record bear that out? Is that part of the record?
That she's an experienced defense attorney?
Yes.
It might have come up at a pretrial, Your Honor. About the fact that I've been in elementary school, no. That would not be part of the record.
No, thanks, Your Honor.
Well, but when you say experience, you know, experience as in has been an attorney for a long time, maybe has done cases, but that doesn't mean that experienced attorneys are necessarily on top of their game and good at their craft or on top of their game all the time. So this could have been a legitimate mistake, could have been legitimate confusion, but whether the attorney was seasoned or you know, 1 year out of law school, if you argue to the jury that an element of the crime was not there, and indeed that's not an element of the crime, why wouldn't that be deficient performance?
Well, I don't think that that's what happened here, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think that what the defense attorney was arguing was she repeatedly, if the court looks at the closing arguments that counsel makes, the attorney repeatedly talks about knowingly. And that's correct, because we do have the burden of proving knowingly for the felonious assault count.
Knowingly what? Through the punch or knowingly?
Knowingly caused serious physical harm. And in this case, of course, serious physical harm is statutorily defined, but the serious physical harm that ultimately resulted in this case was the victim's death. The victim was punched, was rendered immediately unconscious, fell to the ground, sustained fractures to the skull and brain bleeding, which ultimately resulted in his death. And I think that that is exactly the point that she was making when she uses the phrase intend to cause death. You know, if you look at page 523 of the transcript, she says, he didn't do the obvious thing that one would think someone would do with intent to cause serious physical harm. Those are her words at page 523.
So, Ms. Mullins.
Yes, Your Honor.
The knowingly cause serious physical harm to another relates to felonious assault, not to felony murder.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we know from State versus Owens, this case, this court's recent decision in State versus Owens, that a person commits felony murder with a felonious assault predicate when he knowingly causes serious physical harm to another, and that conduct is the proximate cause of another's death. So the mens rea that we had in play here was knowingly, which is why it was appropriate for the defense attorney to focus on that knowingly element. You know, as I mentioned, The facts here are not largely in dispute. In fact, in Mr. Lloyd's brief to the 8th District, he wrote, quote, that the evidence that appellant intended to assault Mr. Powers is not in dispute.
But, excuse me, but she said in closing, and there is no way that Mr. Lloyd could have knowingly been aware that hitting someone with one punch would cause the death of that individual. So wouldn't that be confusing to the jury?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that I think anything would have been clarified by the trial court when it actually instructed the jury on the law. But I think, again, what she is stating is that he didn't knowingly cause this serious physical harm. And we see that argument a lot. In fact, we saw it in Mr. Lloyd's briefing at the 8th District, where they were arguing that it wasn't probable, it wasn't likely that one punch can ultimately result in the injuries and death that it resulted in here. We see that argument made routinely throughout the state of Ohio, and it's largely been rejected, including in the 8th District and 10th District and other districts throughout the state. So I think what she's arguing is consistent with the arguments that we see in these one-punch cases. I think that's also in line with the first proposition of law, or one of the propositions of law that Mr. Lloyd asked this court to accept, which it ultimately declined to do in this case.
Counsel, hypothetically, under the facts of this case, had defense counsel requested a lesser included of involuntary manslaughter, would it have been appropriate for the judge to give that instruction?
I don't think so under the facts of this case, Your Honor, because I think, so involuntary manslaughter would have required a misdemeanor predicate.
Can that be assault, just misdemeanor assault, if the finder of fact found that he had definitely intended to cause physical harm, but not necessary serious physical harm?
Well, and I don't think so. The 8th District did actually address this, Your Honor, when it reviewed under the plain error argument under the fourth assignment of error. And there is case law that the 8th District adopted here, but it has been applied in other circumstances, where when the victim ultimately does suffer serious physical harm, which is unequivocally what happened here, that an instruction on assault for the physical harm would not be appropriate. So I think under the facts of this case that it wouldn't have been appropriate to get an assault instruction. And if there's no assault instruction, then there wouldn't have been an involuntary manslaughter instruction.
So I want to clarify, the proposition of law number 2 reads, for purposes of a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, the presumption of reasonable trial strategy can be rebutted by evidence of trial counsel's persistent misunderstanding of the elements of the offense charged. So that passage that I quoted to you from the closing argument of counsel, you're telling me that doesn't even evidence a persistent misunderstanding?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that she had a persistent misunderstanding. I truly don't. I think if you look at page 523, she states the standard exactly. And in the other sections where she's talking about intent to cause the death, not understanding the intent to cause the death, that's not because she's saying that the state had to prove some specific intent to kill, because of course we don't. She is talking about the lack of intent to cause serious physical harm, which was her entire focus throughout the trial because of the overwhelming evidence that existed in this case of identity. So the only thing that really left as a triable issue in this case was the mens rea, which is what she focused on primarily in her closing argument. But I don't think that the record in this case reflects a misunderstanding on the attorney's part.
Well, counsel, do you think we could answer the proposition of law that Justice Bruner just read about a rebuttable presumption of effective assistance of counsel? Can we answer that question in the affirmative but still affirm the decision of the 8th District?
I think so, Your Honor. I think all presumptions are rebuttable. So I'm not suggesting that there's a circumstance where a fundamental misunderstanding of the law wouldn't necessarily result in the relief that the defendant's requesting. I just think that it doesn't apply in this case. I don't think that she had that fundamental misunderstanding. And what I would note is that you have Mr. Lloyd, and I think they just said this a little bit ago, the request is, I think, to determine the sufficiency performance prong, as you were talking about, Justice Stewart, that kind of suggests that you have to look at both prongs of Strickland. But the Strickland, the United States Supreme Court didn't even say that in Strickland. In Strickland at page 697, they said that courts need not determine whether counsel's performance was deficient before examining the prejudice suffered. If it is easier to dispose of the claim on the ground of lack of sufficient prejudice, that should of course be followed. So if this can be disposed of entirely on the fact that even if there was error, it didn't prejudice the defendant, that's what the United States Supreme Court has directed courts to look at. Again, I don't think that there was error here, but even if this court were to find that the defense attorney misstated the standard in her closing argument, the defendant certainly wasn't prejudiced by it. As the Eighth District went on to analyze, the lesser-included instructions should not have even been given in this case, based on the facts that we have. So there was no prejudice suffered by Mr. Lloyd at all.
So felony murder, as opposed to a lesser-included offense, is not prejudice?
Well, there was, the Eighth District found, and I don't think it's properly before this court, whether or not the trial court should have instructed just on its own on the lesser included offense.
I understand, but if that's not prejudice, what is?
Well, it's not prejudice because under the facts of this case, the evidence would not have supported an instruction on the lesser included offense.
I understand, but even, I'm not looking at trial court error, I'm looking at the performance of counsel, whether counsel should have asked for it, and the difference between the difference between a felony murder conviction and any other conviction that could come about, I mean, you're saying that's not prejudice?
No, I'm saying under the facts of this case, Your Honor, that that's not prejudice. I'm saying under the facts here because he would not have been entitled to the lesser included offense instruction here. So certainly in some circumstances, it might be the case where the defense attorney, because of a misunderstanding of law, should have requested a lesser included instruction and did not. So maybe in those circumstances, there might be evidence to show that was ineffective assistance of counsel. Now, this court certainly suggested otherwise in State versus Griffey.
Okay, but let's just, one more thing on this. But the fact that the felony two, felonious assault, could result in death and that would then directly go to murder without any intent that's specific to the murder, that really wasn't clear.
From
counsel's arguments, and it's difficult to see that. It would be difficult, I think, for most any officer of the court to say that attorney clearly understood what the elements of both offenses were.
I think that she did. She was focusing on our lack of ability to prove that his actions knowingly caused that serious physical harm, which is the standard that we had to prove for felonious assault. So
she said intent to kill.
She didn't say intent to kill. She said intent to cause the death.
Thank you. That's what I meant.
But she, and again, I think that is in context of the fact that the serious physical harm that ultimately resulted in this case is the victim's death. We do have felonious assault cases, of course, throughout the state that are one-punch felonious assault cases, or the victim does not ultimately die. But unfortunately, that's what happened in this case, so that's the serious physical harm that we're left with, which the defense has conceded that that's serious physical harm in their reply brief to this court. So I think that she was actually appropriately focusing on the mens rea attack for our felonious assault count, because there is no, and Your Honor is completely correct, there is no separate intent to cause, to kill, required for felony murder. We know that. But I don't think that's what she was saying. And I think
she said, but he did not knowingly do so with the intent to cause death. We're asking you to find him not guilty of murder.
And I think that that's because she's referencing death as the serious physical harm, and that there was no intent, there was no knowingly intent to cause that serious physical harm. And I think she's very clear about that at page 523, at the summation part of her closing arguments, where she specifically says, he didn't do the obvious thing that one would think someone would do with intent to cause serious physical harm. I mean, she says that verbatim.
Sure, but that last sentence I read you, the only thing she said after that was thank you. So those were her last words to the jury.
Was that?
I don't want to believe that she was trying to confuse the jury purposely. I just don't think that it would be a good thing for us to accept that that's acceptable for anyone who's an officer of the court to do.
I certainly would hope that she was not trying to mislead the jury. I don't think that's what happened here. I don't think that's what happened here. I think that she was focusing on what she perceived as our inability to prove knowingly for the felonious assault. It's not uncommon in these type of cases for like an all or nothing approach, so it wasn't uncommon, I think, for her to not request a lesser included instruction. And again, one wouldn't have been appropriate here regardless. But I think that the transcripts accurately show that she knew what she was doing in this case. And regardless, under the facts of this case, the defendant did not suffer any prejudice. So any Strickland analysis would fail either way. I see that my time is up, Your Honors, and pending any questions, the state is prepared to rest.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel? Almost 5 minutes left.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor. I would like to, in my rebuttal, mostly address the state's position that this case was improvidently allowed. At the beginning of my argument, I talked about what is actually before this court. And what it is an insufficient analysis that took place at the 8th District. Cronnie Lloyd raised quotes from his transcript, said that his counsel did not understand the law and that it impacted decisions she made. When the 8th District wrote their decision, they did not address any of those factors. And that's the problem.
Counsel, was the focus by Mr. Lloyd on her trial performance strictly, or was there any discussion about a failure to be up to speed for negotiations with the prosecutor?
Your Honor, in the 8th District, I do not believe that we raised that particular issue. I'm aware that my briefing to this court, I used that as an example of how if an attorney is operating with a misunderstanding of the law, it necessarily will impact every aspect of representation. I just don't particularly have evidence of that here.
Counsel.
What you mean is you don't have evidence that their rejection of two or three plea offers was based on, what I read seems that their focus or their rationale for that is she was going with an all or nothing defense strategy.
Correct, Your Honor. I don't have in the record to show that it impacted the rejection of plea agreements. The way that this issue was packaged before the 8th District was also about an all or nothing strategy in regard to—
But only within the confines of the trial.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yes.
Counsel, one question. Your friend on the other side said a lesser included instruction would not have been appropriate. Do you agree with that?
I do not agree with that. However, it does go directly to the prejudice prong and whether or not the failure to include those instructions had a reasonable probability of affecting the outcome.
How do you get to the lesser included?
But in my proposition of law one to this court was regarding mens rea that is in cases like this and was not taken by this court. However, I think that the record shows, regardless of what this state may say, the record speaks for itself on what counsel was saying. And if that is what she believed, she would also forego the opportunity to develop other viable defenses. such as arguing the correct mens rea and or developing for the inferior degree offenses the potential provocation that the jury may have seen on the video. So while I think that they are appropriate, to the extent this court disagrees with me on this record, it is a byproduct of failing to understand the elements that that the client was up against. And if there's nothing further, that concludes my argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, ladies. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.